Welcome back. In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
Thank you, mate. We're all voyagers on a journey aboard The Last Ship, the bold new album by Sting, his first new music in a decade. Sting admitted considerable ambivalence about making the setting to this work and these songs so specific. Something in his considerable songwriting experience told Sting to be more generalized in order to make the songs more universal. But the musical theater experts with whom he collaborated loved the color, the characters, and the struggle that Sting had grown up in next to the Swan Hunters Shipyard near Newcastle in northeast England.
You know, I was born and raised in Warsend. It's never been a pretty place. It's a tough place. Nonetheless, I'm fiercely proud of it, of being from Warsend. The ships they built there were the biggest ships ever built in the world. And yet there was always an ambiguity, you know, that shipyard had one of the worst health and safety records in Western Europe. I mean, it was a tough life that these men led. A lot of them hated the yachts, but they were fiercely proud of the ships they built. They did with their hands, they could see this thing. And I went to many launches as a child. I went to many. I lived in one of those streets. I was born and raised in Gerald Street. One of those streets leading down to the Swan Hunters. And that memory of the ship at the end of the street is emblazoned in my memory bank. And we would go to the launchings. I'd stand on the pavement and wave my Union Jack as the Queen Mother came down the street in her Rolls Royce. She actually looked at me. I swear she did. She noticed me.
Impressive.
But that was a big deal. Was a big deal. I mean, we're not just talking about celebrity here. We're talking about royalty coming to your town, down your street. That was a major thing, you know. And in the past, you know, in the olden days, kids would be held up to touch the Queen's garment. It would cure scrofula or something like that. Well, there was the remnant of that. You just see a royal personage, even though it was the Duchess of whoever. It was a big deal. I'd never seen a Rolls Royce before. And I think I got infected a little bit by that sense of, gee, I want a different life to this one. I want that life, that glamorous, I want that. And I think the seed of the life I have now was probably there, you know, seeing where I lived and what that life was. They visited us for, you know, once a year. They'd come and make a speech and throw a bottle at a ship. And I thought, you know, the ship gets too big to come back. It's from there, but its job is elsewhere. So my thing about Warsend is ambivalent. You know, I love it. I'm so happy I'm from there. I'm sad what's happened to the town. You know, the pit closed at one end and the shipyard closed. And it used to be a thriving community. The High Street was thriving. It really was a community.
The shipyards, the gaffer says to me, I want you to go to the store, lad, and get a few things you see. Now here's a list, can you read, lad? Can you read it back to me? And me and the boys listen while we're having our morning tea. Now reading was me pride. When I left school at 14, there wouldn't be no problem here, I'd show them I was keen. But when I starts to reading, they just couldn't hold their mirth, hugging themselves and spluttering like they was giving birth. First up a brace of sky boots and a pack of the nail holes neat, and then three cans of tartan paint and that's me task complete. The gaffer pats me on the head and sends me on me way. He says, don't come back empty handed, lad, or I'll have to dock your pay. So I gets to the store all nervous, and the quartermaster there pulls the list out of me pocket, and I starts to read all square. Well, I hadn't barely finished when a storeman's face turns red. He gave me such an evil look, I thought I'd soon be dead. First off, a brace of sky hoots and a packet of nail holes neat, and then three cans of tartan till that's me task complete. The storeman swipes me on the head and sends me on me way. And he asked for me efforts, and such was my first day. that evening, and me mother says to me, "How was it, son? How was your day? Sit down and have some tea." I told her of the list I'd read and the trouble I was in. I couldn't go back tomorrow, the calf would have me skinned. First off, a brace of sky hoops and a pack of them yellow hoes neat, and in 3 cans of tartan gin, and that's me task complete. Me mother swipes me on the heat and sends me on me whip with a kick in the ass for me efforts, and such was my first deal. Now listen here, you little bugger, come here, I want you to go to the store, get us a left-handed screwdriver, a bubble from me spirit level, a wire mesh oil can, and a long stand with a kick in the ass for me efforts, and such was my first
From Sting's The Last Ship, that's called Sky Hooks and Tartan Paint, featuring the vocal of AC/DC lead singer Brian Johnson. But decades before Back in Black, a young Gordon Sumner would be found most Saturdays in the local Wall's End music shop.
Bradford's, the music shop, was underneath the Gorman Cinema, and I used to buy my guitar strings there and made a friend of Mr. Bradford who had no roof on his mouth. It's hard to understand it, but I got to understand his language. I could figure it out. I was always in that shop, buying records or guitar strings. I just spending time in there among music. And he sold sheet music too, as well as records. And you could listen to records in there as well, 45s. I'd spend most of my Saturday in there. Well, we didn't have that many records, but yet we had, my mother bought Carousel. She bought West Side Story, My Fair Lady, Oklahoma, South Pacific, which wasn't one of my favorites, but I listened to those records like they were the Bible. If you scratch me, I'll start singing Oklahoma. I love that music. And I sort of fell in love with augmented chords, you know, these things that Richard Rodgers used to write. This musical is full of those things, just little references to that love, that homage to that musical form, you know, because I think, for me, the musical's apogee was in the late 40s and the 50s. West Side Story was late 50s, I think. But that was my musical education. I didn't study at a conservatory. I just pored over records. My first professional job as a musician was in the University Theatre, Newcastle, in the pit, playing the bass for Joseph Technicolor Dreamcoat, which I loved. I thought it was great. I think it was their best work, actually, the simplest, most direct. Yeah, that was. I began my professional life in the theatre, never imagining that I would ever attempt to write something or ever end up on a stage of one. But I was happy in the pit, and I was very proud of my 60 quid a week that we got. It was never my intention to write a rock musical. I don't think rock and roll necessarily fits into the theatre. It always seems a little bit fake. It's too small. The sound is too small to really create the visceral energy of a rock and roll show, which is, you know, noisy and powerful. A theatre is something that has a smaller kind of music, and that's what I wanted to make, a kind of an old-fashioned kind of musical in a way, which harks back to a different era.
In 1859, the engineer Brunel will build the greatest ship afloat and rule the ocean swell. 19,000 tons of steel they used to shape the mighty keel. It's forged inside the smelter where they made the gates of hell. And the name upon the contract isn't Bart Brunel. As day by day the monster grew, the engineer Brunel will watch the devil's handiwork, and woe betide a man who shirks or slows the pace that build the keel. 19,000 tons of steel, anyone with eyes to see is but a brighter hell. And the name upon the draftsman's chart isn't Bart Brunel. A river tower's on the hull with his apprentice lad. He'd served his time with the alderman, some say it was his dad. 200 men upon the shift, but when the day is done, the count is 198 before the setting sun. They searched the yard all through the night until the morning bell. No more delays are countenanced by his and Bart Brunel. And so they work a double shift to make the time in full.
no mention of the missing man. They seal the double hole. Ship was launched upon the tide and all the townsfolk cheered. A brass band played, but not a word of omens they had feared. But before the afternoon was out, the celebration wrecked. A dignitary clutched his heart and collapsed upon the deck. Now doctors can revive him, as the telegraphs will tell. And the name upon the coffin, Isambard Brunel. And now upon the open sea the mighty ship did plow. But many feared the darkness and the shadow of its prow. An explosion on the lower deck would take the souls of five, with a growing superstition among the sailors still alive. The captain and his boy are lost while rowing to the shore. The crew will threaten mutiny and say they'll work no more. They began to say the ship was cursed, they hadn't even seen the worst. They'd signed on able-bodied men, but they wouldn't sail to hell. When the name upon the manifest is Isambard Brunel. For 14 years that ship will sail, misfortune taken hard. The owners barely find a crew to reach the breaker's yard. And as they take the plates apart, unseal the double hull, the breakers called the foreman over. They'd found a human skull. And then they find the younger man, perforce to understand that in the hour of their torment, he'd reached his father's hand. In 1859, the engineer Brunel would build the greatest ship afloat and rule the mighty swell. The final shift was over and the breaker's hammers fell. And the name upon the manifest, the contract signed in hell, was the same as on the draftsman's chart. One Isambard Brunel. And what comes out, it comes from your subconscious, your memory, your unconscious. Sometimes you put stuff down that you realize is much too revealing, actually, about you. And that's not your first thought. You realize that there are elements of this character that may well be you. I swear I didn't think about the name Gideon and the name Gordon being close. I've no idea why I chose that name. I like the name. It has a kind of biblical resonance. You know, I think, you know, it's important to understand about The Last Ship, but it's not social history. It is an allegory, if you like. It's an allegory about the importance of work or the importance of community. And so anything that informs that myth-making process, you know, a name like Gideon is a sort of mythic name. And so I'm comfortable with that.
Sting introducing the character Gideon, the protagonist in The Last Ship. Still to come, Sting shares his thoughts about 21st century globalization. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you get a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Sting aboard The Last Ship.
Welcome back. In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
That is true, my friend, but just like Sting's hometown, my beard has faded with time. Sting, who once wrote a song, One World Not Three, when he was with the Police, now is concerned with some unintended consequences of global trade, travel, and communication.
You know, War's End was a community, and it had everyone worked in one place, really. I was very proud of working in one place. And then these very abstract economic theories came about in the Thatcher years that put the idea of community as a, you know, secondary idea. I don't agree with that. I never did agree with that. I think community is vitally important for the economy. I mean, we need communities for economy. And these abstract ideas, you know, in the long run, they destroy the economy. And we've seen that happen. And the idea of this play is to bring back the importance of work, that men and women need to do things. They need to make things. At the end of the day, they need to see what they make. I'm very fortunate. I work with my hands every day. I practice. I play music. It's very ephemeral what I do. It disappears immediately. But I still work with my hands. And that's good therapy. And I think individuals need that sense. Communities need it. So that, you know, the conceit at the center of this play is that this society, this community, is got back together by making something for no other purpose than just to prove that they can, to say we're here and this is what we do and we should be respected for it. And it's I'm not sure if that's a solution at all, but it's within the allegory. I think it's connects with people. People understand that need.
When a man of my age shaves his face in the morning, who is it stares back and greets him? The ghost of his father long dead all these years, or the boy that he was still wet in the ears, or the terrible sum of all of his fears in the eyes of this stranger who meets him? So his glance really strays from his chin or his jawline to face up to the truth of his soul. It's the eyes he avoids, so afraid to acknowledge something strange, unexpected, out of control. There are times when a man needs to brave his reflection and face what he sees without fear. It takes a man to accept his mortality. I'll be surprised by the presence of a tear. It was only an arrangement, a practical arrangement. I forgot the first commandment of the realist's handbook. Don't be fooled by illusions. You created yourself and fall in love with someone when she loves someone else. Like a covering of snow on a winter's night, it glistens and it sparkles in the moonlight, but it's gone by the morning. How quickly it melts. You still love her, but she loves someone else. Where does that leave you? You self-styled man of vision. You feel stupid, you feel angry. Are you losing your mind? To destroy the one she loves, does that become your mission? Like a pantomime villain with an axe to grind. To regain your self-respect, hold your head up like a man. Use the ice around your heart before it melts. But you're not fooling anybody. You're only fooling yourself. Like a covering of snow on a winter's night, listens and it sparkles in the moonlight, but it's gone by the morning. How quickly it melts, you still love her, but she loves someone else.
A beautiful torch ballad by Sting from The Last Ship. No doubt you've noticed several religious references in the language, characters, and settings reflecting the iconography as well as geography inherent in the fabric of Sting's youth.
Yeah, I have a very ambivalent attitude towards religion. You know, I was brought up Roman Catholic, and you know, there's a big Irish community in War's End, big church, St. Columbus. And I was an altar boy, and I was reciting the catechism every morning. I used to go to church every week, but at the same time, I didn't really feel that connected to it. My mother was Church of England, so you know, we had this sort of mixed marriage thing going on. At the same time, I loved the music. I loved the music in church, you know, the hymns. I loved Gregorian plainsong, you know, singing in Latin. I had no idea what we were singing, but I loved the way that music worked. Some of the liturgy baffled me. Some of it I found beautiful. The priest in the play is really a throwback to liberation theology, you know, the idea that you would help the poor, which I think is what the church should do, rather than the right wing of the church, which took over later on. So he's a throwback. But the church has a place in community, and it's there to protect the poor, not to protect the rich. I don't regret my religious upbringing. At all. I took it with a pinch of salt, you know. I couldn't believe in the virgin birth. It struck me as ridiculous. You know, why, if God created this whole thing and this wonderful mechanism for making life, why would he bypass it by some kind of conjuring trick? It was, even quite young, of the idea that only Catholics could get to heaven. It struck me as being odd because my mother wasn't. So I was lucky. I was lucky that I had what was good about it and also a kind of objective distance from it. But yeah, it does inform a lot of the imagery that comes up. That ship is an ark, and this symbol of a ship is interesting, you know, it's full of symbols, you know, the last ship.
Like his hero Paul Simon, Sting has always been a solitary songwriter with bands as small as a trio. So composing a stage musical with a huge cast and collaborating with theater directors has presented a definite learning curve.
My history has been a lone songwriter. I never really had a collaborator that I could work with. I've often wanted a collaborator, but I've done most of my work alone, and I sit and I work out the music and the lyrics, and I would present a song to whatever band I was in as the finished thing. Take it or leave it, right? I usually took it. For the first time, I have to present, even though this whole project was my idea, present the work to professionals who will say, well, that works for us and that doesn't. They'll be very articulate about why doesn't work, usually because it's not advancing the narrative, but quite cut and dried about that that's not useful to us. So I've had to learn a humility there that I hadn't practiced before. At the same time, I feel, because they can do that to me, I feel that I'm in safe hands, and you know, I'm working with people at the top of their profession who are not blowing smoke at my rear end. They're very professional. If something works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't work. They don't care who I am. And that makes me feel very comforted. I do not want to be surrounded by courtiers who are telling me, that's wonderful. Yes, everything you do is fantastic. And I will then go to sleep. So I'm surrounded by pros. It's a collaboration. And at the end of the day, you know, we have to be proud of what we've done together. And it has to work. You know, and the acid test is putting it in front of people. You see one person yawn, you're dead. There's one of the major characters is a priest who encourages the men to go back in the shipyard and build a ship to get back to, you know, for their self-esteem, for their selfhood. And he's dying. It's a plot giveaway. And we needed a scene with the leading lady. They need to talk about, you know, life, philosophy, her love affairs, and him dying. And there was a scene there, and they said, well, we want a song there. So I wrote a song called So to Speak, which uses the metaphor of that ship has already sailed. It's no good me trying to save my life anymore. I'm dying. That ship has already sailed.
I seriously said it's prolonging me life if I'll only submit to this surgical knife. But what are the odds on a month or a week when the betting shop's closing its doors, so to speak? When you're tied to a pump and a breathing machine with our x-rays and probes and our monitor screens, and they'll wake you up hungry, saying, how do you feel? And then you're stuffed full of pills and a barium meal. Prolonging me life now, that's some kind of joke. I'd be laughing me head off and I'd probably choke. The spirit's still willing, but the rest of me's weak now, the bets are all off, and the prospects look bleak when you're laid like a piece of old meat on the slab. And they'll cut and they'll slice and they'll poke and they'll jab, and they'll grill you and burn you, and they'll wish you good health with iridium, chemo, and God knows what else. Well, you can't fault the science, though the logic is weak. Is that really an eternal life we should seek? That ship has sailed, that ship has sailed, that ship has already sailed, so to speak. Our mission is more than a struggle for breath, for a few extra rounds in a fight to the death. When our mission is love and compassion and grace, it's not a test of endurance or a marathon race. For love is the saber and love is the shield. Love is the only true power we wield. And eternal love is all you should seek. That ship will be ready to sail, so to speak.
I hear what you say, 'cause I've heard it before. But I'm afraid if I let what is passed through my door, how long would you stay, a month or a week? When that ship has already sailed, so to speak, should I settle for something that's safe on the sail? What would it profit me, what is it worth, if I lose something precious, completely unique? When it's only eternity's love we should seek. For when that ship sails and the course has been set, and the winds in the offing and the sails have been let, and the hatches are full and the hull doesn't leak, the ship is all ready to sail, so to speak.
Tired and fading and losing the light, and I've nowhere to tell if it's day or it's night.
Follow your heart, it's the harbor you seek.
And this ship is ready to sail, this ship is ready to sail, this ship is ready to sail, so to speak.
What a touching, tender reading of a song by Sting in duet with Becky Unthank on The Last Ship.
Well, I've never written for women before, and you know, the keys are obviously different. They have a different key register to deal with writing lyrics for women, you know. And it's not just a matter of pronouns, it's, you know, it's a whole different mindset. You have to put yourself in the head of how would a woman feel in this situation, which has been useful for me, because, you know, I've been a confessional songwriter, self-involved songwriter most of my life. Putting myself in someone else's shoes is different, exciting and challenging and absorbing. So I'm enjoying that process. I'd like to do more of that, actually. I think my understanding of women is an ongoing research project, you know, and you know, my wife and my daughters are there for you know, access their psychology. You know, they think differently to us, men, thank God. And I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of it. I actually prefer the female mind. I think I find it fascinating. But they're different. They approach logic differently. They approach ethics differently to the way we do. Passion, truth. They're all slightly different, but a fascinating study. You know, women are massively powerful in a profound but not obvious way. I hope my love of women comes through in this thing. You know, they're very powerful creatures, and we have to respect them and bow to their needs and bow to their logic and about their sense of the world, the kind of world they want to create. I suspect is much better than the one we can on our own as men. You know, we've lived in a patriarchy for too long, and it's failed. The world is failing. I think more women need to be involved in the way we run the world, in politics. Certainly in the arts. The arts is a forerunner of, you know, what will happen in society generally. Women are much more powerful. Look at the pop charts. There's a little Petri dish there of, you know, female power. Yeah. It's hard for a man to get in the top 10 now. It's all Adele and all of these wonderful, fantastic women. I'm not complaining. Perfectly happy to be a subservient male sometimes, you know.
You promised me, my Jackie, on the day that we got married, you'd build a boat of dreams for me someday. A vague romantic notion that would sail off to some ocean, but in my dreams we'd get there one fine day. He hasn't been the same since the yard closed down, like all the other men in this broken town. He'd end up by the river as his thoughts turned black. I said, pull yourself together, pet, and come home, Jack. Whenever we had sorrows, we'd always say tomorrow. We'd catch that ship of dreams and sail away. What happened to my Jackie, that big bald man I married? It's hard to watch your fella waste away. He sits and stares at nothing. That chair's an upright coffin. The cat's got his tongue and there's nothing I can say. He's never been the same since the yard got closed, but he's dressed every morning in his working clothes. Cup of tea and a sandwich from his old rucksack, but it never should have happened to a man like Jack. If I came into money, it'd be all for you, me honey, and we'd build that ship of dreams and sail away. Jackie.
And there's a solo by sister Rachel Unthank on Peggy's Song from Sting's The Last Ship. We'll board that ship of dreams and sail away in just a moment. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and always on inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Sting, about to launch The Last Ship.
Welcome back. In the studio, and I'm Sting with Redbeard, and he still has it.
Aye, that I do. Those unfamiliar with the thick Geordie accent of the characters in Sting's The Last Ship shouldn't be intimidated. Sting readily admits that his fellow countrymen in London, for instance, wrestle with it too.
When I first went to London, I would have to say things two or three times until I just started to speak, you know, without an accent. So consciously as well as unconsciously, you know, you live in London or you live in New York, and you start adopting the musicality of where you are. I mean, it's just simple. You know, when I'm in France, I try and speak French with a French accent. But some people don't lose their Geordie accent at all. I think the language needs to be succinct and understood. But there's a color to it, and also the way I've written a lot of the lyrics, they're dialect. They are, the rhythms are a dialect. And the show we did in New York this week, most of the actors are American. So I had to coach them in, you know, say, what have you got? I said, what do you got? Or if you say a phrase like your ears, you don't say your ears, you say your ears. It's one word. And so that's going to be an interesting challenge. The musicality is Geordie. It doesn't necessarily have to be broad, though. I think Jimmy Nail's very good at that. He enunciates very carefully. He's very Geordie, but he enunciates and you hear exactly what he's saying.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. My toast on one side. You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue. A walking cane here at my side.
Though somewhat surprised that Sting would compose in the grand tradition of Broadway, need look only as far as his second solo album, For Englishmen in New York, from Nothing Like the Sun, with the title straight out of William Shakespeare. The plans are for Sting's The Last Ship to debut on Broadway in 2014. Sting's best-selling autobiography turns out to be only the first step.
The engine that drove me was an important one, and it was escape. I wanted to escape my family. I wanted to escape the environment that I didn't feel had any future for me. That engine ran me for a very long time. I just drove myself to escape. Luckily I did. But having escaped, I now am grateful for that and where I come from. And I don't think anything you do can get away from who you are. Why would it? Why would you want it to? Even if it's sad. You know, I wrote that book and it was quite a painful process to dig up things that I'd perhaps buried for good reason. And yet the end result was therapeutic. You know, I ended up forgiving the people in the book, forgiving myself, giving myself the benefit of the doubt, giving my parents the benefit of the doubt, people who I thought at the time had betrayed me, but really being grateful for what they gave me ultimately and the man they made me. And so it was an important piece of self-help, if you like. And I suppose I've used songwriting in a similar way. I used my history to tell my story. I'm proud of my story. I think it's a good story. It's not finished yet. But I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of where I come from. And I'm grateful. That's a simple abiding emotion in me. It's gratitude at this point. I'm 61 years old. I'm grateful.
Aye, the footmen are frantic in their indignation. You see, the Queen's took a taxi herself to the station, where the porter, surprised by a lack of royal baggage, bustle her and three corgis to the rear of the carriage, for the train it is crammed with all Europe's nobility, and there's none of them famous for their compatibility. There's a fight over seats, I beg pardon your grace, but you'll find that one's mine, so get back in your place. Ah, but where are they going? All the porters debate. Why, they're going to Newcastle, and they daresn't be late, for they're launching a boat on the tyne at high tide. And they've come from all over, from far and from wide. There's the old Dalai Lama, I and the Pontiff of Rome, every palace in Europe, and this neat bugger home. Here's the Duchess of Cornwall and the loyal Prince of Wales, looking crushed and uncomfortable in his top hat and tails. Way, they haven't got tickets. Come now, it's just the detail. There was no time to purchase him, and one simply has to prevail. For we'll get to the shipyards, or we'll end up in jail when the last ship sails. Oh, the roar of the trains and the cracking of timbers, the noise at the end of the world in your ears, as a mountain of steel makes its way to the sea, and the last ship sails. And whatever you promise, whatever you've done, and whatever the stationary life you become, in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, and no matter the weave of this life that you've spun, on the earth or in heaven or under the sun, when the last ship sails, oh, the roar of the chains and the cracking of timbers, the noise at the end of the world in your ears, as a mountain of steel makes its way to the sea, and the last ship sails.
The mountain of steel heads down to the sea, and the last ship sails. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Sting. Special thanks to Matthew Lamott of Interscope Music. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Red Beard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2013, all rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. And for the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net.